MNF is accepting volunteer applications to be part of our on-air team.
And welcome. This is Latinx.
Welcome to the Soul Kitchen. It is I, your resident chef, Big Eddie G.
Join your favorite voices on 88.5 FM, WMNF.org, and our HD channels. If you've always dreamed of being on the radio,
I would love to be on the radio.
Now's your chance.
Join your listening supported radio station, WMNF.
Apply under the programming tab at WMNF.org.
Hello and welcome to the Sustainable Living Show on WMNF Tampa, where every Monday we bring you conversations on sustainable issues with local experts. Your hosts today are Tanya Vitovic, myself, and Kenny Coogan. Bill Grace is on the boards and Clark is answering your calls. Today we are talking about Governor Ron DeSantis signing the Florida Wildlife Corridor Act into law on June 29th and what that means for both us and the creatures that live here with us.
We are speaking with Jason Lauritsen, Chief Conservation Officer of the Florida Wildlife Corridor Coalition. Lauritsen's experience includes environmental conservation and restoration, land management science, wetland protection, and woodstock recovery in the Western Everglades. Jason, welcome to the program.
Jason, are you there?
I am, yes. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
You have more than a 20-year career in conservation and natural resources management. Where did this passion start for you?
Well, you know, in my backyard. I actually come from the Midwest, so my first four exposures to Florida had nothing to do with the wild areas. Very much had the tourist experience. But when I finally got out into wild Florida, and saw some of the phenomenal natural areas here, it opened up my eyes to just the tremendous wildness that is a part of the state, and it drew me in. So, you know, from my grandparents' farm as a kid to Corkscrew Swamp Sanctuary in Southwest Florida, I was hooked.
Very good. Today we're talking about the Florida Wildlife Corridor Act. Can you tell our listeners what a wildlife corridor is?
Absolutely. Yeah. A corridor is an area that connects two larger habitats when you think about wildlife corridors. And the Florida Wildlife Corridor is 18 million acres in size, approximately. And that's a big number. It's hard to get your head around. But just to give the listeners an idea, it stretches all the way from the Florida-Alabama border at the farthest west extent of the panhandle, all the way over to northeast Florida, where Florida meets the Okefenokee Swamp, and then runs down through the state to Florida Bay and the Keys at the southern tip of the state. So it's a significant area, and it connects our state parks, our state forests, our major springs, national parks and forests, and it's a mechanism to link critical habitats for wildlife and water.
Okay, so it's very important. And what is the role of the Florida Wildlife Corridor Coalition?
Yes, well, our mission is to champion an effort to protect, connect, and enhance that 18 million acre landscape throughout the state. And we work with agencies at all levels, and we work with nonprofit and NGO partners, and we work with private landowners and the general public to align messages, to leverage efforts to get conservation done. And since you teed that question up, Kenny, this is not something that one organization or entity can accomplish. It's a massive sort of vision for the state, and there are a lot of heroes. Some of those heroes tackle getting budgets passed that would allow for on-the-ground land acquisition. Others are those doing the research on wildlife and plant communities and hydrology to determine what are the most important areas to protect. And if you fail to protect those, what are the costs? And then you also have land managers and folks that deal with planning. So there's no end to the number of partners and heroes that we try to work with.
You are listening to the Sustainable Living Show on WMNF Tampa 88.5. If you have a question We're talking about the Florida Wildlife Corridor Act. You can give us a call at 813-239-9662, or you can send us an email at dj@wmnf.org.
9663. I apologize. That was a typo on my So it's 813-239-9663. Sorry about that. We'd love to hear from you. So you say 18 million acres are these two larger areas in the corridor. Do we own all of these acres?
No. Great question. If I could provide a little perspective here.
Provide all the perspective, please.
Yeah, excellent. The first conservation land was bought in the state in 1903. That was Pelican Island National Wildlife Refuge. And since then, Floridians have been recognizing valuable habitat throughout the state and making purchases. So we have almost a 120-year record of generations of Floridians acknowledging the value of a piece of land. But we've not come close to that 18-million-acre mark. We have approximately 10 million acres conserved, and that falls into two categories. Not all of that conservation land is owned fee simple by an agency. A lot of that is in a working land conservation easement. So I would say that we still have a long way to go. A little over 8 million acres of that 18 million acre footprint doesn't have any conservation protections on it. And as a result, we like to think of that as an opportunity area, an opportunity to connect to really important habitats, which are homes to our diverse wildlife and plant life, and secure those for future generations.
So when you say that we own the 10 million acres, we're looking for that other 8 million acres. Can you explain a little bit, how are we going to get these 8 million acres? Is it privately owned? Is it state owned? And then is that what this money is for? It was like $300 million, right? That's a significant amount of money. So yeah, could you explain a little bit of about where we're going to get these acres from?
Certainly can. To start off with purchasing land or purchasing conservation easements, we are not suggesting that it's going to be possible to secure 8 million acres of additional parks and preserves that would be publicly owned. So some considerable portion of that is going to have to be in conservation easements, and looking at how we approach that. If you're not familiar with the two major programs that do land acquisitions in the state, I'll just introduce those briefly. There's a program that we know as Florida Forever, which is run by the Florida Department of Environmental Protection and the Florida Department of Agriculture and Consumer Services runs a program called the Rural and Family Lands Protection Program. And both of those are the state's key drivers for land acquisition and conservation easement acquisition. So the $300 million that came through federal stimulus dollars to our state has been designated for purchase within wildlife corridors, and specifically as a part of that Florida Forever program. So those dollars are going to go for fee simple acquisition or conservation easements, where conservation easement is where a ranch or a tree farmer might decide that they're going to agree not to put houses on their property in the future or change the landscape to a commercial development, and they will agree to keep it in its natural state in perpetuity. So that even though they own it and they may still have cattle or may still pull trees from it, it will remain in a conservation footprint. So that's two examples. So
And I think that the taxes go down for you, right, if you have a big property and you put a conservation easement on it?
Yes. Tax incentives are one of the benefits to that landowner that exercises a conservation easement so that they can continue pumping money and jobs into that local rural economy, and they can also acknowledge that they're going to protect that property from more intensive development. So there's this compatible use. It's not a full-on nature preserve, but there's benefits. And those working lands are really critical connective tissue for the corridor.
You're listening to the Sustainable Living Show here on WMNF Tampa. Today, we're talking with Jason Lortson, the Chief Conservation Officer at the Florida Wildlife Corridor Coalition. So we're talking about this amazing piece of property in the center of Florida that allows wildlife to kind of roam freely, right, with the black bears and Florida panthers, and making sure that that land is protected. If you have any questions for Jason, give us a call at 813-239-9663 or email us at dj@wmnf.org.
Governor Ron DeSantis signed the Florida Wildlife Corridor Act into law with a unanimous bipartisan support from the Florida House and Senate. And this bipartisan support is pretty rare these days. And Jason, how did we achieve this?
Well, you're right. That bipartisan support was rare. I come into this issue an optimist, and what I've seen in talking to Floridians for years, for my two decades in the state working on conservation issues, is that Floridians recognize the beauty and the value of wild spaces and wildlife. It doesn't matter what political stripe you're from. That's something that we're all a part of. And if we can focus on those common areas and bring people together and try to stay out of the many controversies that can distract us, then that's to the betterment of these sorts of big, broad efforts. It's not going to be easy from here on out. I mean, protecting some significant portion of that 8 million acre opportunity area, there are going to be spots there that's really difficult to do that. But in general, on principle, we all pretty much agree this is important and we value it and we want to protect it. And that's one of the things that act does, is it puts that acknowledgement of this landscape is better as a whole, as contiguous connected parts, rather than fragmented islands of park or preserve.
The Act sets the groundwork for healthy and green infrastructure. What does that mean? What is healthy and green?
Well, okay, so you're talking specifically, I believe, about the access provision in that bill?
Yeah, how are we measuring that?
Yeah, I think that will... There's a lot of this bill was written without really specific and concrete definitions, so there can be some interpretation in there. So I would say that when this comes down to encouraging different levels of government and different jurisdictions to help complete the corridor for a community, as an example, in the Four Corners area of the state, going from the Green Swamp to the headwaters of the Everglades, there's a stretch there that runs across I-4 and across U.S. 27 and through some of the theme park areas of the state. And that area has Lake Louisa State Park on one end and the Disney Wilderness Preserve area on the other end, and a whole bunch of very different mosaic of land uses in the middle. So when you look at access points here, there are opportunities within that connection that's unprotected to provide trails, paddling trails and hiking trails for the public to be able to access and engage in some parts of the corridor. And it's not appropriate for folks to have access to every single place throughout the corridor or necessary. There are some places that it's good to have roadless, trailless wilderness areas. Those access points are a nod to the flexibility within the corridor, as big as it is, for communities to create connection, not only for the green space, but also for the public to enjoy it and to appreciate it.
Tanya mentioned that this would help black bears and the Florida panther. What other species of wildlife are the most at risk if the corridor is not protected from new development?
That's a great question. And when Tanya mentioned that, I wanted to point out we use black bears and Florida panthers as sort of totems to inspire and get people to pay attention to this. But the Florida Wildlife Corridor certainly will help those two species, but it's about much, much more. Just to give an example, the Lake Wells Ridge area is this nearly 150-mile ridge that runs nearly north and south through the state, this high sandy ridge. And there are so many different endemic species that exist nowhere else but in those little areas. And protecting land around little patches. As an example, there's a plant there called the Avon Park harebells, a small little plant that people thought was extinct and had been extirpated from that area until some botanists stumbled upon one, keyed it out, and realized there's some Avon Park harebells that's still here in Highlands County. And they monitored it. They did surveys around the area and found another population. So there were two known populations of this small population. Part of what the corridor does is it seeks to provide protection around populations like that so that land management activities can go on to perpetuate those species and to keep them alive. And one of those patches happened to be in an area that you could not do prescribed burning because of the homes in the area. So when you can't prescribed burn around a patch of scrub habitat, your scrub is going to change. So part of this is to deal with the dozens and dozens of its endemic species along that really biodiverse, rich area of Lake Wells Ridge, for scrub jays, for manatees, for red-cockaded woodpeckers. It's a long, long list, but I'm glad you asked the question.
Good. I was also going to ask if it positively affects birds, and you listed a couple of bird species because sometimes when I think about a corridor, I think about animals that are walking, but yeah, the birds need connected pieces of land as well.
Good point, Kenny.
Yes, absolutely. Our organization does expeditions, we've had 2,000-mile expeditions that illustrated just the connected nature of the state. And then we've done shorter, small, focused expeditions since those two really long ones. And the one that we did in that Lake Wells Ridge area, we put out a short documentary called The Wild Divide, which is available and accessible on our website, FloridaWildlifeCorridor.org. And that takes you through some of that scrub habitat. And you'll see there Reed Bowman from Archbold Biological Station doing some research and capturing some scrub jays. And we learned from the scientists like Reed that a scrub jay sees a lawn, a landscaped manicured lawn, as a barrier. It fragments their landscape. But a citrus grove doesn't necessarily. So where that scrub jay won't cross over a neighborhood, even if it's a fairly short distance that you can see across to the trees on the other side, it will go up to a couple of miles traveling over an orange grove. So something that fragments for a scrub jay might not fragment for a black bear. So it's a complicated network of green lights, red lights for these wildlife, and we need to overlay the understanding of science to help us realize what our impacts are and where there are opportunities to make connections.
You are listening to the Sustainable Living Show on WMNF. Today we're talking with Jason Lauritsen, Chief Conservation Officer of the Florida Wildlife Corridor Coalition. If you want to give us a call, our number is 813-239-9663, or you can send us an email at dj@wmnf.org.
Yes, Jason, following up on Kenny's question about brown bears and that, or bears in general, I was perusing your website and saw something about one of your cute little devils, M34. I was wondering if you could not tell us a little bit about him, but also tell him how he's doing now.
Yeah, M34 was sort of an eye-opener for me personally. M34 was a young black bear, a young male bear that was part of Joe Guthrie's study on black bears. And he happened to capture and collar M34 so that it had a GPS tracker on it. and we got to see where that bear moved. And it was a dispersing bear. Just to give you an idea, there are different parts of a animal's life cycle. And for a black bear, as it gets to around 1 or 2 years old, it may disperse out into a different area to find its own home range. And this particular bear, M34, left on a journey, headed north from where it was initially collared, and ran into I-4 about 150 miles away from where it was initially captured. And it could not cross I-4. It spent about 4 days in the vicinity of I-4, going through communities, looking like it was trying to make a trajectory across I-4 into the Green Swamp. And it was thwarted. It turned back and headed south and went all the way to the western edge of Lake Okeechobee, and was around that area when the collar fell off. So we don't know what M34 is doing right now, but we do know that in a 2 month span, that black bear traveled over 500 miles. And that's a lot of territory to cover, and it's moving quickly through areas. And these dispersing bears, here's the value of an M34 or any dispersing bear, is it's carrying its genetics possibly to another population to provide genetic strength and health to it. And had M34 been able to cross I-4 and go through that green swamp, it had traveled enough after that point that it could have gotten to the Chazawitska bear population in the Nature Coast. And had it been able to do that, its genes would have helped that rather small, rather genetically not diverse population and been a little breath of health and life into the gene pool. So M34 was this bear that tried but couldn't make it across. So part of our goal is to take the green connections that exist there and to work with the FDOT and different regional road building entities to, when they do additions or changes, ask them to put in a wildlife crossing, whether that's a land bridge going over the road or whether that's a tunnel going under the road, and the appropriate fencing to help bears and panthers and other wildlife make it through. We call those permeability features for roadways.
Now that seems like an amazing feature and a necessary feature if we want to actually protect these animals. And you say 500 miles. That seems like like the impossible journey. Was it looking for territory? What is the normal territory that a panther or a bear needs? How much land do they need?
Tanya, that is an extraordinary number. And in just 2 months, 500 miles in 2 months is phenomenal. Our first expedition covered 1,000 miles, and it took 100 days. So this black bear was moving, and it was looking for a new home range and new territory. And when a bear establishes a home range or a panther establishes a home range, it's really going to live the rest of its life out in that home range unless it's displaced by another more aggressive bear or a panther. So that black bear is likely hanging out among the Highlands Glades population, having found some spot on the map there. And it's not doing these long distance dispersals anymore. It does that once. And now it's hanging out and doing a little commuter routes. So the corridors it's using would just be to follow the seasonality of, say, for instance, saw palmetto berry blooming. And when it expends the saw palmetto berry resources in one patch of pine flatwoods, it'll move to the next one. It'll have this little home range and route worked out. So those kinds of pieces of habitat are important, and those pieces are often part of ranch lands and state parks, and it's these dispersal corridors that really are the hardest ones to protect and to identify. So that's a big part of it. There's more to talk about regarding panthers as well. You asked the second part of that, Tanya, but
it was just how much land does a bear and a panther need? Was that ending part of the question?
Well, a Florida panther, an adult dominant male, will have a home range of up to 200 square miles.
Wow.
It's hard to get your head around, but that's a reference point. The Corkscrew Swamp Sanctuary is 20 square miles. So, when I was working at the Corkscrew Swamp Sanctuary, we would often have visitors that would comment about, "I'm so glad that Corkscrew is saved, now we have a place for our panthers. But the reality is Corkscrew Swamp Sanctuary is not adequate, a home for even one panther or a pair of panthers. You would need 10 Corkscrew Swamp Sanctuaries to satisfy the home range of just one male. So when we look about at these landscapes and we think about how much land we've saved, we need to think of it through that animal's perspective.
So when, and you mentioned the word fragmented land, could you explain what fragmented land is and then what happens?
Yeah, absolutely. If you look at the home range maps on wildlife, the historic ranges of the black bear or the panther, you'll see they cover the entire state. And over time, as land use changes, some habitat becomes inhospitable, and they're not going to be spending time on, say, a beet field or a tomato field or a parking lot. So those areas become inhospitable and of no value. And as Florida has grown from just a few hundred thousand people to 22 million people, we have a lot of landscape that's no longer good habitat. And in many cases, our roadways and our communities have severed connections between really great habitat. And so you end up with these islands of habitat that don't have these good connections to neighboring places.
You know, and it's funny because I had a bear walk through our yard trying to find its way, obviously, though the one in Pinellas County. Yeah. So that's, you know, that it happens when you have fragmented land, they end up walking through your front yard. You're listening to the Sustainable Living Show here on WMNF Tampa. Today we're talking about the Florida Wildlife Corridor Act with Jason Lauritsen. And if you have any questions, give us a call at 813-239-9663 or email us at dj@wmnf.org.
And on line one, we have Rob from Thonatasassa, and he has a question about a conservation that's adjacent to his property.
Hello. A fascinating show. Thanks for having your guest on. I live over here in the Thonatasassa, and next to my property, which is partially fenced, but it's pretty much in tatters here and there. We don't really care about fences that much out here, but I have what they call a conservation area, and the water ebbs and flows during the year. Right now, it's at an all-time high. It's come up about 30 feet onto that side of my property, and it recedes when it's drier, and it kind of made me wonder what's going on here, but I was told that's what it was. Now, there are all sorts of birds, wildlife. I think I saw an ibis the other day, which I hadn't seen before, but there are, you know, egrets out here. And then we get foxes, red foxes and whatnot. But I'm just curious, what is that part of it, or is that part of this corridor? And what role do these sort of conservation areas play? And, I mean, you know, like I said, I see all kinds of things out here.
Yeah. So Rob, thank you for calling in and asking the question. I'm not certain exactly where your property in that conservation area is in relationship to the Florida Wildlife Corridor, but I can tell you that there are three priority layers within the Florida Wildlife Corridor, and this the map is delineated through modeling, and the state paid for back in the 1990s a modeling effort called the Florida Ecological Greenways Network, and there's a resource online that has the Florida Ecological Greenways Network map available to you. It's I'm going to give you the website here. It's fnai.org. That's the Florida Natural Areas Inventory website. They have a great interactive map on that, and it has all five layers of that Florida Ecological Greenways Network map available. You can also find that at our website as well, floridawildlifecorridor.org. And then if you find your property there and see where it is located in relationship to that, the Florida Wildlife Corridor is really the state-to-regional network of lands. It's like a tree trunk running through the state with the main branches. But that does not necessarily delineate, by any means, every single important piece of conservation land in the state. The priority 4 and 5 layers on that Florida Ecological Greenways Network map also show the regional to local connections. So even if your property is not in the Florida Wildlife Corridor's main trunk, doesn't mean it's not important nor part of a working and active corridor.
I feel very fortunate because I know there's just tons, like there's ducks and, you know, there's tons of things out here. Now, some of the properties are fenced off, like you have people that have maybe a pasture with horses, but I can tell for sure that you have the foxes especially. I know there's a burrow in sort of an underbrush area, you know, and they come, you know, they move around. Like some in the summer you don't see them, but they come down, you know, and it's fascinating that how they, like you were talking about the bear, you know, having to kind of cut through a suburban yard or a front yard. But I feel that way about the foxes. You know, I have 2 dogs and the one likes to chase, you know, I feel bad about that. But you can see these different species sort of migrating back and forth throughout the year. So, yeah, I think it's very important that people try to promote and preserve anything that, that acts as a, you know, like a marshland, or that, you know, brings these, gives a home to these various animals. Thanks for your show. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you, Rob, for calling in.
And I just posted that website on our Facebook page, so if anybody couldn't take note, it's there.
Very good. So, Jason, we have a text message. Jason, are you familiar with the Discreet Ranch or the Mormon Ranch?
I am not, but I'd like to hear about it.
Okay, so Bubba sent us a text message, and he said, could you speak about the development plan? That project would be awful for the critters. And the Discreet Ranch, or the Mormon Ranch, it's the largest cow-calf ranch in the U.S. It's about 295,000 acres.
Yes, okay. My apologies, Kenny. I pronounced that Deseret.
Okay.
Deseret Ranch, yes.
It's a Mormon word.
Yes. Yeah, I am familiar with it, and I know that there's a sector plan that is being worked out for that area. It is definitely a really important piece of the Florida Wildlife Corridor. That's a very large section. It's largely right now in undeveloped pasture land, and you have a lot of cattle, but you also have a few male Florida panthers that have been up there. You have black bears, lots of caracaras and wood storks and other wading birds. This is a very important property, and we are aware and in conversations with folks that are part of creating that sector plan with the express purpose of making sure that any features that go in there have Florida Wildlife Corridor connectivity rules in it, so that we can maintain as much of the function of that area as possible. So that's an important piece to keep on people's radar.
Very good. I love caracaras. I think it's very hard to find them. But so it's a bird of prey that look gorgeous. We have an email from David, and he says, there's a shocking amount of housing and retail development approaching the Corkscrew Swamp Sanctuary. The sanctuary is still a great place to visit, but it's sad that greedy developers are taking over the wild areas. Jason, you have any comments?
Yeah, my first visit to Corkscrew was, I think, back in 1990. That area of Southwest Florida has just changed tremendously. I was just down there last week, and David's right about the development. There's a lot of development going on there, and it's if you're not living right there and you just see it every now and then, it is startling how quickly that is occurring. And again, it speaks to the fact that Florida, we're getting 1,000 people a day moving into the state. That's not the only place in the state where you have rapid development growth, and it's reaching out into these rural areas, and it does encroach on these natural resource gems that we have, and it does occasionally, quite often, further fragment these habitats, and the risk is that we would end up with a bunch of central parks throughout the state, and we'd preserve up to this hard boundary, but there'd be no meaningful connection. I liken it sort of to a circulatory system in a body. You have these large wildlife patches like Corkscrew or the Ocala National Forest or the Kissimmee Prairie Preserve State Park that have nice populations of wildlife that use it, and they need to be connected through that circulatory system of land so that wildlife and water can be communicated across those distances. And what we do in those spaces is really critical, and making sure that the regional planners, the developers, the consultants, all recognize the value of the land that they're going to be developing in, and that we can safeguard the function so that we don't lose the important places that we love.
Rob, the previous caller, he sent a picture of his property, so I'll share that with you, Jason. It's a nice ephemeral Great. Pond. So we're the Sustainable Living Show, and we're talking about, when we talk about sustainability, we're trying to balance people, profit, and planet. So can you talk about how this act impacts the people in Tampa and all across the state?
Yes. Well, Tampa, the Hillsborough River, you know, the green swamp. Tampa does not have an overlapping footprint with the Florida Wildlife Corridor's priority 1, 2, or 3 layers. Tampa's not within the footprint. However, it's downstream of a really critical area in the green swamp. That green swamp is the headwaters for the Hillsborough River, also for the Peace River. And the water resources that we enjoy, the water quality coming down the Hillsborough River, the quality of water in the bay are all affected by what happens upstream. So when we're protecting the Florida Wildlife Corridor and natural areas, watersheds are front and center on our minds, and those, the quality of our water, the timing of our water, the acreage of our wetlands, which provide so many different ecological services to people, those absolutely affect coastal areas like Tampa, like West Palm Beach, and Miami and so forth. So just because you're not living in the corridor itself, you're benefiting from it. Through, and again, talking about water, when you get too dry because you've lost too many of your wetlands, you end up having droughts, saltwater intrusion, and wildfires. Those are costs that are paid by everybody in a county. So there's a definite cost to that. Also, when you look at smaller rural areas, our food production throughout the state, whether it's crops or cattle or timber, Those areas are an essential part of the rural economy. And if we lost the ability to have vibrant, effective, sustainable farming in the community in places, then what would happen to that land? What would be the alternative land use for that property? So keeping working lands in place with conservation easements to ensure that it doesn't convert to something that would be more fragmenting is certainly a goal and benefit, not just to the rural economy, but to everybody downstream.
You are listening to the Sustainable Living Show on WMNF Tampa 88.5. Today we're talking with Jason Lauritsen, Chief Conservation Officer of the Florida Wildlife Corridor Coalition. If you have a question for Jason, give us a call at 813-239-9663. Or you can send us an email at dj@wmnf.org, and I will read it to Jason.
So, Jason, how do we encourage agencies and private landowners on preservation design and configuration to maximize the local landscape and benefits to wildlife, maybe through conservation easements or some other way?
That is going to be critical, and part of it, a big part of it, I think, Tanya, is education. We live such busy lives. We get pulled in so many different directions that people understanding the practical opportunities that they have to actually make a positive difference is something we need to continue to impress on people's minds. So making sure that those county commissioners, the local planning agencies, their infrastructure folks, that they all have on their map, on their wall, our map, or somewhere on one of their saved tabs on their computer, a link to the Florida Wildlife Corridor map, so that as they're planning and thinking about making changes in their jurisdictions, that they recognize where the corridor is and that they work to plan around that. Also, that they would know what tools are available to help them. And by tools, I'm talking in large part about funding and funding resources. There are a number, I think 25 or 26 different land trusts that work throughout the state of Florida. And some of them have very local jurisdictions and some of them are statewide. But these land trusts can help NGOs and landowners and agencies navigate some of those financial resources that are available to do conservation easements or to do an acquisition. There are programs like the Florida Communities Trust, which will provide funds for more urban or suburban parks and green connections between communities that would maybe not be on folks' radar. If we can look at where we put filter marshes for water quality and stormwater treatment, and where we locate hiking paths and parks and preserves for the public, if we do that with a mindset of making landscape connection, we can save some of these really important but fairly off the radar parcels within some of those urban and suburban footprints, and that would be a big help.
And so when you say that we have 8 million acres to buy, $300 million to spend, if somebody's interested and they're in this area, if they're interested in either getting a conservation easement or selling their land to the local government to be a part of this act, how would they go about doing that?
Yeah, well, I want to also add that there are county programs as well. So the two programs that you mentioned, you know, that $300 million, that's part of the state budget for land acquisition. And you can go to the Florida Forever website. If you just type in floridaforever.gov, I believe you can navigate to that FDEP website. The Florida Department of Environmental Protection runs Florida Forever. And again, the Florida Department of Agriculture and Consumer Services, known as FDACS, they run the Florida Rural and Family Lands Protection Program. You can go to those websites and connect with the staff there to see how to get your property on the Florida Forever list or on the Rural and Family Lands Program list. And that's one start. But you might be in Orange County or in Collier County or in Lee County, and there are other land acquisition programs at the county level, which also you could qualify for. And sometimes those are easier to get on. The best resource I would say for you would be to contact one of your local land trusts and have them help you navigate, because your property might not qualify for Florida Forever. And if not, that doesn't mean that the issue's closed. There are other things that you can do.
Awesome information. You're listening to the Sustainable Living Show here on WMNF Tampa. We're talking today with Jason Lawitson with the Florida Wildlife Corridor. If you have any questions, give us a call at 813-239-9663 or email us at dj@wmnf.org.
And the Sustainable Living Show is a big team. And on the line, we have Scott, and he's going to tell us a bunch of sustainable events that are happening in our area. Hi, Scott.
Hi, I'm here to tell you about some cool events that are happening this week and beyond, so get your writing utensils ready. This Thursday, September 30th, the St. Petersburg City budget hearings are taking place at City Hall and showing live on the city's website from 6 p.m. until 8 p.m. Saturday, September 25th, the St. Pete Youth Farm is hosting their Autumn Community Work Day from 8 a.m. till 10 a.m. Youth Farm is located at 1664 12th Street South in St. Petersburg. For more information, go to stpeteyouthfarm.org or find them on Facebook. Also, Saturday, September 25th, is the 13th Annual Garden Fest and More, hosted by the Plant City Garden Club from 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. at the Train Depot, 102 North Palmer Street. Free admission, free parking, lots of plants for sale, crafts, and more. Also this Saturday, the Florida Permaculture Convergence is hosting immersive workshops at Wonderfield Farm and Grove in Floral City. Workshops include site planning tools and techniques, waterworks and earthworks, and functional uses of bamboo in the landscape. For more information, go to flpermacultureconvergence.org. Saturday, October 2nd, is the Friends of Salt Creek and Suncoast Sierra Club are hosting a creek cleanup and community gathering at Bartlett Park in St. Petersburg. For more information, go to friendsofsaltcreek.org or find them on Facebook. Also Saturday, October 2nd, is the Trinity Farmers Market from 9 a.m. until 1 p.m. at the Commons at Trinity, 1540 Little Road. Find out more at trinityfarmersmarket.org. And also on Saturday, October 2nd, is the Brooker Creek Native Plant Sale from 9 a.m. until 2 p.m. at the Brooker Creek Preserve Environmental Education Center on Keystone Road in Tarpon Springs. Find out more at friendsofbrookercreekpreserve.org. That's what's happening. Peace.
Thanks, Scott. I appreciate it.
Mm-hmm. So we have, Jason, we have an email from Tina in Brooksville. Today's program with the Florida Wildlife Corridor guy, Jason, is spectacular. Heart emoji. And make no mistake, the FNAI link is tremendous. I was very pleased he mentioned it. So, Jason, you have worked and developed tools and redefined regulatory approaches to improve impact assessments and mitigation for wetlands and listed species for state and federal agencies. What are all those steps required to do that?
Oh, well, that, I have to say, that's a, first of all, Tina, thank you. Yeah. That was a really nice note.
Especially with the heart emoji.
Yes.
I love that. Kenny, that's a long question. I know we're almost up with our hour. What I can say is that we have this federal policy of no net loss of wetland functions, and we try, we hope to live up to that. That's a really complicated thing to do, and it starts with science and recognizing what those important functions are. And one of my favorite quotes of all time is from Aldo Leopold, and he says, the first rule of intelligent tinkering is to not throw away any of the parts. And when we approach the ecosystem, as complex as it is, it's really important to recognize that we don't understand everything. We have to approach change with a bit of academic and intellectual humility. We make an impact, and we might not always recognize until years later what the consequences of those impacts are. So from the standpoint of wetland permitting, there are a lot of really important functions, just like what's going on in Rob's backyard with the ebb and flow of that water coming up and down and seeing the wading birds coming in at certain times of the year and capturing those concentrating fish populations there. It's a really critical part of the ecosystem, and if we don't measure and value those and work towards protecting them and keeping our ledgers aligned so that we're knowing where those impacts are and where the lift is, then we're going to lose things and not know until it's too late. That's part of what the Florida Wildlife Corridor concept is. We know that we're going to miss some things as we grow. But if we are tracking what the wildlife is doing and trying to look at these large landscapes with a long planning horizon, we're going to end up a decade or two from now, a century or two from now, having saved more of it than we would have otherwise. So that's got to be the goal. It can't just be what's happening next year. We need to have long planning horizons with sustainability and resiliency in mind.
When legislatures or when you are talking to the government, is it easy to make people believe that there's value in panthers and bears compared to the beautiful wood storks or not as charismatic animals?
I would say it depends on your audience. I think everybody appreciates the beauty of those big charismatic wildlife. Not everybody wants a panther necessarily in their backyard. So helping people to understand that we are not seeking to create panther and bear pathways in new places throughout the Florida landscape. What we're looking at is there are connections that are already there that bears and panthers are already using. And what we don't want to do is to sever one existing natural connection and forcing those bears and panthers to go into your neighborhood because their preferred route is gone. So yes, absolutely. Getting the messaging and misconceptions out there and addressed is really important so that people can connect their appreciation for the beauty of something with action that conserves it and protects it for future generations.
You're listening to the Sustainable Living Show on WMNF Tampa. Today we're talking about the Florida Wildlife Corridor. Give us a call at 813-239-9663 or email us at dj@wmnf.org if you have a question or something that you just want to say about it. So I have a question. So this $400 million, I think $100 million of it is going to the preserving the land that we've already purchased, and $300 million is going to land acquisition, where we're going to be buying more land. Is this something that is for this year only, or is this something that we're looking to do every year?
That good question, Tanya. That $400 million that you referenced is just for this budget year. And every year there are certain allocations for conservation and land acquisition, and the levels of that fluctuates wildly. And I can say that for our state agencies, it is difficult for them to ramp up staffing and have the services surrounding the kind of land deals that need to be done when the volume of funding changes so wildly. I would love it if we could fully fund Florida Forever and make that a robust program, and also Rural and Family Lands and the Florida Communities Trust to get funding in all three of those programs to help out with this, because $400 million is a lot of money compared to what we've had in the previous, say, 8 or 9 years. But it's not going to come close to covering that 8 million acre hole that we have in the corridor.
So how can people help? If we're looking to do this every year in order to protect this piece of land that is obviously valuable for our ecosystem, yeah, and environment, how can people help with that process?
Well, I want to go back to what I talked about at the beginning of the hour here, and that this is a team effort. There are state programs and state efforts. There are national programs and national efforts, and there are ways for people to contribute at those large state and national levels with some of the conservation organizations that work at that level. But there are also local chapters and local NGOs that work at the local level. And making sure you know what your county commissioners are doing and what the developments are locally, making sure if you have relationships with some of the planning staff or some of the local politicians, make sure they know that the Florida Wildlife Corridor map is a tool that they should be using. And when you see projects or developments going on in an area, just reference that to that map and see how big of a deal is this. Is this something that's severing an important conduit for wildlife? And please go to our website, inform yourself so that you're educated. I would love it if you'd sign up with our newsletter. Again, that's FloridaWildlifeCorridor.org. Again, just be an ally and plug in with one of the many local conservation organizations that are working on this big problem.
Well, Jason, thank you so much for being an amazing guest. And we as a community appreciate everything that you are doing. You are listening, or you have been listening, to the Sustainable Living Show here on WMNF Tampa. Stick around next week. We are going to be talking about fermentation. So this is your community conscious radio station, WMNF Tampa 88.5.
Thank you, Jason.
Thank you. I appreciate that, Tanya and Kenny.